HPR's The Exchange podcast is brought to you in part by Granite State College, Keene State College, Plymouth State University, and the University of New Hampshire. This is your university system. Visit usnh.edu/yours to learn more.
The Exchange podcast also gets support from the New Hampshire Chiropractic Association, an organization of professionals providing a non-invasive, non-surgical approach to healthcare, tailoring treatment plans to meet individuals' needs. Learn more at nhchiropractic.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Thursday marked President Biden's 100th day in office, and like his predecessors, Biden has tried to get a lot done in this early period. He's introduced three major spending plans, while at the same time trying to address the pandemic, climate change, and immigration. Today in The Exchange, we discuss President Biden's first 100 days, as well as the origins of this concept of the first 100 days as a predictor of an administration's future. Exchange listeners, as always, we welcome your questions. What's your take on the new president's first few months in office? What stood out to you? What have you especially liked, and what have you not liked? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org, and our phone number is 800-892-6477. Now we're going to hear from several voices this hour. We begin with Ayesha Roscoe. She's NPR's White House correspondent. Ayesha also covered the Trump White House for NPR and the Obama administration for Reuters. Ayesha, a big welcome to The Exchange. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So what were the general expectations for Joe Biden coming into office back in January, Ayesha? And let's start with the Democrats. What were they hoping for?
Well, I think there was an expectation that Biden would jump into, obviously, responding to the coronavirus pandemic, that he would bring back a more traditional White House, and that he would bring back focus and experience. But there was also, I think, concern from some of those on, the left, that Biden would be very moderate, that he might repeat some of what they view as mistakes of the Obama administration, where they felt like, you know, the Obama administration waited too long or tried to reach out too much to Republicans and never really got anything in return, went too small. And so I think there was some concerns because Biden, as you I'm sure well remember, was not the most progressive of the candidates for the Democratic ticket. He was viewed as the moderate.
Well, and sure, I remember, you know, following all of them during the New Hampshire primary, which seems like a trillion years ago. But yes, he was considered the more moderate candidate. How about Republicans, Ayesha? What were they expecting?
You know, I think Republicans were, I think for the Republicans, it was less about the specifics, right? Like, I think Republicans were expecting a Democrat to be in office, and then they're responding accordingly. And their thing is, you know, if he comes in, there's going to be big spending. Whatever he did would have been called big spending and, you know, big government, and they're going to kind of push back on that. It basically put Republicans back on a footing that they're more used to, right? Being the outside party, you know, talking about a Democrat, you know, talking about big government and things like that, which they were not doing during the Trump administration. That was because Trump wasn't ideological. It was like a totally different Republican Party when it came to big government spending, all of that. And so this kind of put them back more, you know, with the Democrat in the White House. I think Republicans kind of went back to their usual, you know, talking points.
Well, and one big complaint that we've heard from Republicans is President Biden talked, you know, in his campaign, in his inauguration speech, in his first 100-day speech last week about bipartisanship. But Republicans have said he's not being bipartisan at all. He's doing what he wants. He's barreling stuff through and not making an effort to reach out to Republicans. How much of that have you seen, Ayesha, in your coverage of the White House?
When it came to the first big COVID relief package, there was some nominal outreach. He had some meetings, but it was clear that the White House was just going to, you know, the White House and Democrats were ready to move ahead. They were going to move forward. They said there was no time to wait. And so they didn't seem to try, you know, really hard to bring Republicans on board. They have been making this argument, trying to flip this idea of bipartisanship into a different, you know, to a different framework. Basically, what the White House has done and what President Biden has done is tried to argue being bipartisan is not just getting Republicans to vote for a bill, but it's pushing policies that most Americans or a bipartisan, you know, a slice of the American public supports. So that's what they've tried to define bipartisanship that way. But of course, Republicans are saying you said you would bring us together. You need to be reaching out to us so that there, you know, so that there can be laws and things that have support from both parties. That hasn't really happened very much.
Oh, that's interesting.
Up until now, though.
Yeah, sort of a different definition of what bipartisanship is. And I want to get into the specifics in just a moment, Ayesha, but what was the big sort of overall message from President Biden's 100-day speech last Wednesday, where he sort of marked this time period?
His big message was basically that this is an opportunity for that there are some things that are so big that the government has to get involved, and that there is that this is the moment to make those investments to make sure that the U.S. is competitive long term. What Biden has tried to argue is that if these massive investments in infrastructure and in the middle class and helping families and all of these things, if that doesn't happen, then the U.S. will be left behind in its competition with China and others, that these investments have to happen. And that's the argument that he was trying to make, that government has to do certain things and it's time to, you know, and it's time to make those investments. A once-in-a-generation investment is what they keep saying.
Well, how much of a fundamental shift is this if all these plans, you know, the American Rescue Plan, the American Jobs Plan, the American Families Plan, the Climate Plan, and so on, if all these plans were to pass, and we'll talk about that in a moment, how big a shift is this? I mean, some people have called this as big as Roosevelt's New Deal.
It is a fundamental shift into the, you know, the way that people interact with government. It is a fundamental shift. And, you know, when we talked earlier about what Democrats expected, some on the left have been pleasantly surprised because they did not expect Biden to go this big. But what Biden seems to be betting at this moment is that the time of, you know, people saying, you know, the government is, you know, being afraid of big government, that this is a different moment. So people aren't afraid of big government, that people are willing to put their trust in government to do certain things, whether it's universal pre-K or 2 years of free community college or, you know, getting lead pipes out of buildings, that this is the moment where people are not going to be kind of looking at it through this Reagan, you know, former President Reagan, you know, the government is here to help and that's a scary thing. But after the coronavirus and all these things that took really major government efforts, that people are ready to accept some more, a bigger role for the government. That is the bet. And it is a bet. So who, you know, he may not win that bet, but that's the bet that he seems to be making.
So Republican U.S. Senator Tim Scott, who, as you know, gave the Republican response to the president's speech, called all these programs a, quote, liberal wish list of government waste, a socialist dream. So the Republicans seem to be sort of betting on the other side that Americans will say, whoa, whoa, whoa. I'm curious, though, Ayesha, about moderate Democrats in red states or even purple states like New Hampshire. How are they viewing this very large expansion of government?
To be clear, they don't have the votes for what they have proposed outright. You know, these big plans, multi-trillion-dollar plans, that they do not have the votes, even from some Democrats, because some Democrats, like you said, moderate Democrats, have raised concerns about the cost of this. Is this too big? So there's going to have to be negotiations. But it may be the case that because what Biden has proposed is so big, if he gets even some of it, it would be a huge deal, right? Like, he's proposed a lot. So even some of these things would be a big deal. And it's not clear that he will get any of it, you know, but he has to convince those moderate Democrats that he is trying to, you know, convince the public, and also trying to convince some Republicans to come along. They want to see at least a real attempt at bipartisanship. And he has to convince them that this is an investment that they can get behind, and that it won't cost them their seats.
Yeah, well, that's the gamble, and we'll see how that ends up in 2022. I even hate to talk about the midterms, but that's always sort of looming over everything. Speaking of the bigness of all this, how is the Biden administration proposing to pay for all this spending?
They are proposing to pay for it by taxing the rich. They want to, they want to raise the corporate tax rate back to where it was before the Trump tax cuts. They also want to tax those who make more than $1 million a year. They want to tax their capital gains at a higher rate, so basically at the same rate as wages. So people who are selling, you know, their stocks or their yachts or whatever they're selling, they want to, tax that, those gains at a higher rate. They also want to beef up the IRS and beef up enforcement. They believe that they could get as much as $700 billion in money from people who are evading paying their taxes. So they argue that this is the rich paying their fair share. But of course, on the other side of that, you have Republicans and some Democrats who are concerned that if you raise taxes like this, that it will hurt the economy, it will hurt growth, there will be less investments. The administration argues that there isn't research to back that up, but that is the concern, that at this point, that raising taxes like this could hurt the economy.
I want to remind listeners that we're talking about President Biden's first 100 days in office. We'd love to hear from you. How have the past 100 days felt to you? What have you liked about the new administration? What has not appealed to you? Let us know by email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 800-892-6477. A couple more questions for you, Aisha, and then I know we have to let you go. Another frequent complaint from Republicans about these first 100 days is what they call the silence from President Biden on crediting the Trump administration for the very rapid, amazingly rapid development of COVID vaccines. How much has President Biden or any of his top advisors mentioned this? You know, Operation Warp Speed that got these vaccines to market so quickly.
They haven't mentioned it very much. They haven't, you know, gone out of their way to credit the Trump administration. I don't think that that's really very common, especially with a former president of another party. The Trump administration did not go out of its way to credit, former President Obama for the, you know, already falling unemployment rate, right? Like, if you're president,
and you get the blame, so take the credit. Yeah.
Yeah, you take the credit. Like, that's the thing. Anything that happens under your watch, you take the credit. So, you know, for Trump to get the credit for the vaccine distribution, he would have had to get reelected. Like, that's just kind of the way it works. If you're a president, you get to take credit for whatever happens.
Has there been anything, Aisha, as a reporter who's covered, as I said, three White Houses, anything that's surprised you about this first 100 days of the Biden administration?
It is still a very different White House because that right now the country is in the middle of the pandemic. So the way that, you know, you don't have the crowds at the White House that you would have had, you know, in times past, and the way that you have to interact with a lot of the officials is through Zoom calls and things like that. So that is different. I'm not surprised by how busy they have been. But I think if anything has been surprising, is that they have really gone very big, right? And I don't know that it's really, you know, with their policies, with things that they're putting forward, they have moved very fast. They seem to be trying to say, we're not the Obama administration. We're definitely not the Trump administration. They're trying to cut their own path, and they seem to have a very clear eye toward the history and legacy of what they're trying to do. And it's not surprising, but they have been very tight-lipped. They ran a very tight ship. That part's not surprising. You know, right now, they're not leaking. They're not doing all that stuff. That usually takes time. The Trump administration was kind of abnormal in that sense.
Oh, it's interesting what you just said, Ayesha. And I had forgotten about that. You know, some people thought, oh, Biden will just be, you know, Obama 2.0. But you seem to be saying, no, that's not the case. He's got his own agenda and his own style.
No. And I think that because even when you look at what President Biden's first 100 days, a lot of it was him saying, I'm not going to do necessarily what Obama did. So like with the COVID aid package, he went big because with the stimulus package, people might remember back in the day when Obama was first in office to deal with the financial crisis, people felt like he went too small. He should have gone bigger. Because they still didn't get any Republicans to support even the smaller legislation. So a lot of this seems to be a reaction to what happened then. It's like, no, we're not going to go small. We're going to go big, and we're going to stay very focused, not getting caught up on, you know, other things that are more controversial. We're going to focus on getting the economy together. That's our focus. We're going to promote it. So a lot of it does seem to be a reaction to that former administration.
We've been talking about President Biden's first 100 days. What about Vice President Kamala Harris's first 100 days, Ayesha?
It has been, you know, to watch her in this historic role. She is the first woman, first Black woman, first Asian woman in this position, and she has certainly been mindful of that. But if she's, you know, Harris is as most vice presidents are, in this kind of awkward place because they, you know, she's not the number one, she's the number two. So part of your job as vice president is not to outshine the president. But she has had some, you know, responsibilities given to her. She's supposed to be dealing with the diplomatic portion of the surge of migrants at the border. So not the border itself. They try to, you know, be very clear about that, but with dealing with the leaders of the other, you know, of the Northern Triangle in Mexico, and how to try to stop the root causes of migration. So that is a very big responsibility that she's been given. It was a responsibility that Biden had when he was vice president. She's also been given this responsibility over broadband and this push to try to get broadband through in one of these, you know, infrastructure packages, which is, you know, a big domestic responsibility, and something that if she's able to help oversee and pull off, would be a very big get for her, presumably when she tries to go for even higher office.
Wow, that's interesting, because that's a big issue in rural New Hampshire, and we've definitely seen more of that with the pandemic and kids trying to get their work done at home, and broadband has been a problem in some instances. Ayesha, we know you have to go. Thank you very much for being with us. I hope to talk to you again.
Yes, thanks for having me. I had a great time. I appreciate it.
That's Ayesha Roscoe. She's NPR's White House correspondent. Well, coming up, a New Hampshire perspective on the first 100 days and what some of these spending plans that Ayesha mentioned might mean for the Granite State. We'll take your emails at exchange@nhpr.org and your phone calls at 800-892-6477. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're exploring President Biden's first 100 days in office, including three huge spending plans and how they're being viewed here in New Hampshire. Listeners, how do you think President Biden has done so far in his first 100 days? What have you liked about what he's said and done? What have you not liked? Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 800-892-6477. For this segment of our show, we're talking with Ellen Fitzpatrick, a professor of history at UNH, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University. Well, a big welcome to both of you. And Professor Fitzpatrick, let's start with you. Before we get into some of the policies, when did this first 100 days framing begin and who started it?
It really began in the administration of Franklin Roosevelt, who was inaugurated in March of 1933. That's when we inaugurated in March. And it was a very low point in the Great Depression when Roosevelt took office. The unemployment rate was 25%. And there was, of course, a global depression going on, and the United States was really struggling, to say the very least. The American people were struggling, say. And so in that first 100 days, Roosevelt has had promised a new deal for the American people and began as soon as he took office to use the powers of the government and to create new powers.
Oh, Professor Fitzpatrick, I'm so sorry to interrupt you. We do seem to be having just technical problems, and it happens with everybody being remote these days. So it is not your fault. It happens. We will call you back in a moment because I do want to hear a little bit more about this history of President Roosevelt sort of kicking off this concept of the first 100 days. And while we're waiting to get Professor Fitzpatrick, Dean Spiliotis, what have you observed about the first 100 days over the many administrations that you've been watching, Dean?
Hi, Laura. It's good to be with you. Yeah, as we were just hearing, the concept of 100 days is really something that began with the New Deal, and it was kind of a convenient and catchy way to talk about the slew of new programs that FDR pushed through after he was elected in 1932 to deal with the Great Depression. You know, since then it's become kind of a media concept. It's an opportunity for there to be lots of reporting about the president. It's kind of a useful shorthand. I think the reality, though, is that in the modern context, as the legislative process has become more polarized and gridlocked and sclerotic, I think it's increasingly a little bit less meaningful. I mean, the reality is, though, that Joe Biden kind of played into it by having a address to a joint session of Congress right around the 100-day mark. But the reality is that it takes a little bit longer, as we're seeing now with the infrastructure proposals, to get a big chunk of programs through Congress. Obviously, we had the pandemic relief. That went through using budget reconciliation, which is a technique that the Senate can use, that Congress in particular, to get through a filibuster in the Senate can be used occasionally, but not regularly. So, you know, we've seen presidents try to rise to the occasion because they know they're going to be assessed. They like to come out of the gate with typically one big proposal, maybe two. If it gets too cluttered, then it gets hard to get anything done. But they're aware that they're going to be judged and that there's going to be a lot of media reporting around the 100 days. But I think as a concept, given the way the process works nowadays, it maybe has a little bit less actual on the ground relevance than it once did. But it's still kind of a fun thing to talk about.
Here we are talking about it.
Happy to talk about it.
And, you know, it's been called, and Ellen Fitzpatrick is back with us. It's been called, and I want your opinion, Professor Fitzpatrick, a predictor of the possible future success for a given administration. Is that just a talking point, Professor Fitzpatrick, or have you noticed that being true? If you can get a bunch of stuff through in the first 100 days, you're going to do okay.
Well, it certainly helps, as Dean said, to get a major piece of legislation through, which Biden has already done. And but I don't think it's useful as a predictor. We can look to John F. Kennedy, who within the first 100 days of his administration had a major disaster with the Bay of Pigs invasion, which was an utter failure, and for which he took public responsibility in a press conference, saying memorably words that we rarely hear, "I am the chief officer of the government, essentially this is my fault." And he, in fact, when the polls were taken of his first 100 days, his approval rate exceeded 80%. It was 83%. Given that he had only won the election by 0.1% of the popular vote a few months before, it was quite remarkable.
And that's amazing.
He went on to be, greatly beloved, of course, in part because of the tragic end of his life and his presidency. So that's one example, and, there are others. So I don't think it's a predictor of how successful the administration will be, but the bigger difficulty is that when Roosevelt was president and really came in transforming the relationship between the federal government and the citizens by a whole series of bills that were passed in that 100 days that were absolutely sweeping and that impact our lives today, that was a redefinition, a complete pivot that really changed the history of the United States for the remainder of the 20th century and into our own time. And no president since Roosevelt has done that. The Depression itself provided that opportunity. Presumably his predecessor, Hoover, could have taken it as well. But Roosevelt came in with a landslide victory. He had a 200-seat majority in the House. He had a comfortable majority in the Senate. And there was a feeling in the country on the part of the Congress that it was imperative that they work together. Someone said in the period that we forgot to be Democrats and Republicans. We just joined together to try to rescue the country from the ravages of the Great Depression.
Wow. Well, and Dean Spiliotis was just saying a moment ago, Professor Fitzpatrick, we were talking about, is this first 100 days kind of a media construct now? Is it something that administrations go, okay, if the media is going to talk about this, let's do something with it? Like, it's kind of a chicken and egg issue. Like, you talked about Roosevelt using this, but at this point, is this more of a media thing or a political thing? Or what's your thought?
I think it's a realistic thing, which is that you've just won an election in this case. Some dispute the fact, but by a reasonable margin, and you're the public has endorsed you, enough voters have endorsed you, and you want to show that you, how you're going to lead and that you can lead. And so I think, and given that both Biden, Obama, Roosevelt, there have been others, are taking office in the midst of a crisis, in two of those cases, a world crisis, it makes a lot of sense to try to do something. Yes, they know they'll be evaluated, but I think the public is looking to see, what can this president do and what will they do now that they have the opportunity? They've campaigned for 2 years telling us what they're going to do. Okay, do something.
And well, that's a great point. Yeah. I mean, we listen to them for 2 years, discuss what they're going to do. Then we've got 100 days to do something. Dina, I want to bring you back in. We talked earlier with Aisha Roscoe about, the president's first 100 days, how she sees it as a White House correspondent. And we also talked a little bit about the 100-day speech that the president himself gave last week. I'm sure you were listening, Dean. What sort of jumped out at you, Dean, from that speech in the big picture?
Well, I think what was had to have been stunning to anyone watching that speech was the environment in the Capitol with only I think 200 people viewing the speech in person, socially distanced, wearing masks. You did have the remarkable historical picture of having a female speaker and a female VP sitting behind the president. So I think that it was not the typical kind of joint address that we would expect, which is usually a packed chamber with 1,600 people and lots of cheering and lots of scowling from the party that is out of power at the moment. In terms of the actual speech, I thought it was a good speech. I think looking at some of the data after the speech, increasingly what we're seeing is that basically Democrats and people who like Joe Biden tuned in, and folks who did not like Biden or who are Trump supporters or what have you decided not to watch. So I think even our viewing habits with the president are becoming increasingly polarized, which I think is an unfortunate thing. I think it's important for whichever party you're in to hear what the president has to say. In terms of policy, what is so interesting to me is that in many respects, Joe Biden is a classic liberal politician in comparison to the idea of being a progressive politician. Everyone talks about how progressive, Biden is, but much of his kind of economic proposals, his what Republicans like to call cradle to grave, big government, a lot of that really has its roots in the New Deal and the Great Society, which came to a screeching halt with Ronald Reagan in 1980, but Joe Biden came of age as a politician really in the 1970s. He goes into the Senate in 72, 73. So he is really very much in that mold. What will determine just how progressive he is how he does on some of the other issues like social and criminal justice reform, dealing with racism, dealing with other kinds of issues that are important to progressives, immigration, gun reform, et cetera. So there are a host of kind of economic issues and proposals in here, physical infrastructure, human infrastructure. A lot of those proposals to me sound very familiar, kind of traditional Democratic liberal policies in the sense of, viewing the government as playing an important and critical role in the lives of our citizens. And then there are these other issues that are important to the Democratic Party that are kind of more progressive in terms of their reformist impulse. And so seeing how he navigates that balance, I think is going to be really interesting. And that's what kind of struck me about the speech.
So Professor Fitzpatrick and Dean, let's go to our listeners. Heidi's calling from Francistown. Hi, Heidi, you're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Thank you. I just want to say that I am delighted with President Biden. And I guess I've got three main reasons for being so delighted. First of all, I think that he has right away, just in the most natural way, set a tone of kindness and reasonableness. And also, just having experience may not mean anything, but in his case, he has learned from experience, he's grown through it, and he's reflected on it. And that makes an enormous difference in anybody working in any situation. And also, he exercises, I think, such good judgment that he knows what the country needs. And because of the way in which he has grown from and reflected on experience, he knows the many ways to get things done. And so for me, he is just a great relief, of course, and a very promising president.
Well, Heidi, thank you for weighing in, and I appreciate it. And Professor Fitzpatrick, one last question for you. Given what we've seen from President Biden's first 100 days, as everybody's been saying, going big, what are you going to be watching for, or what might you expect to see in the coming months?
I think one of the interesting questions is to what degree can the Democratic Party kind of pull together? Biden clearly is trying and will try to work with whomever he can possibly bring along in the Republican Party to get this legislation through. And, the Democrats will default to, ramming it through on their own if they have to. What Senator Manchin will do from West Virginia will be important to this story. And, you know, I think that as your caller suggests in her remarks, that if these programs really do help individuals, if they reach out to Americans in a way that people really feel the results of them, they won't feel them immediately in most cases, but that's going to make a big difference. And that's another thing that Roosevelt did. People had confidence in him. They could see that he was doing things as the country hopefully opens up. We don't know what's going to happen with the pandemic. Hopefully, you know, we're turning a corner there. The economy appears to be brightening. So these are all good signs for Joe Biden. But, you know, the country remains very divided, and the Republican Party appears quite set on, you know, resisting, you know, any of these measures that Biden is proposing. So that's disappointing.
Well, and you mentioned Senator Manchin, a key moderate Democratic vote in the Senate that President Biden will be looking for sure. Yes. Professor Fitzpatrick, I know you have to go, so thank you very much, and we'll talk to you again. Thank you for being with us
today. Thank you very much. I enjoyed it. Bye-bye.
That's Ellen Fitzpatrick. She's a professor of history at UNH. Well, coming up, Dean Spiliotis will be staying with us. We're going to talk more about Joe Biden's relationship with New Hampshire, also the visits from others in his administration, and we'll hear more of your comments. You can call in like Heidi did to 800-892-6477. Tell us what you've liked about the first 100 days of the Biden administration, what you haven't liked. You can send us an email as well. It's exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, how to support pollinators in your outdoor spaces, large or small. Email us your questions before the show to exchange@nhpr.org and join us for that conversation tomorrow morning, live at 9. Today, we're talking about President Biden's first 100 days, and listeners, tell us how you feel about it. What were your expectations, and have they been met or not? Let us hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook or call 800-892-6477. With me for the rest of the hour is Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. And Dean, let's just take a little time to remember the relationship between President Biden and the Granite State. He did not even come close to the top in our primary in February of 2020.
Yeah, that is true. I think he finished fifth, I believe. And so it was not an auspicious start for President Biden here. And, you know, there's a lot of talk now about states like Nevada trying to switch to a primary and move up and challenge New Hampshire. And they, one of the things they point to is the fact that, you know, Biden did not perform particularly well here. And he did much better once he moved to South Carolina. So we'll see how that plays out. But nonetheless, you look at public opinion data and he's reasonably popular here. I think his approval rating is just over 50% in the state, 51 or 52, something like that. He won pretty comfortably, as did our Democratic congressional delegation, even though the state legislator flipped to the Republicans. So I think there's still there's certainly a fair bit of goodwill, and particularly among Democrats, a number of the proposals that we're seeing from Biden now on things like free community college, support for education, more support for childcare. Some other kind of what they're now calling the CARES infrastructure or human infrastructure. A lot of those proposals, family leave, et cetera, a lot of those proposals are things that the last state Democratic legislature were championing, and they just weren't able to get it past Chris Sununu's veto pen. So I think there is a connection there. And also Biden's approval among independents still looks pretty good. So I think in that sense, even though it wasn't a great primary for him, I think he's in reasonably good shape in the state for the moment.
Let's take another call, Dean. This is Karen in Grafton. Hi, Karen. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in today.
Good morning. morning. I'd like to ask people to consider pressing Biden to be a little more aggressive with the economic packages. The market is certainly looking good and approving. In terms of the women's financial situation, the men in the Republican Party only want to approve jobs for men in construction and building, and we need women supported by a support and increased funds for women to get jobs for taking care of elders and ill family members. And it just seems like they could be, you know, we don't know what he's saying in the underground in communication, but I wish to hear more about that kind of approach, especially since so many women are raising children alone.
Well, thank you for calling in, Karen. And boy, there's so many packages, Dean. I mean, there's three, but then they're enormous. If memory serves, there is a lot in one of these economic packages around money for caregiving, money for childcare, and so forth.
Yeah, and I think if you add up all of the proposals that are currently out there from the administration, we're talking something like $4.1 trillion in total proposals. You know, Karen raises a very important point, and I alluded to it a little bit in my last comments. There's a real debate in Congress about the meaning of infrastructure. So Republicans are counter proposing something in the range of maybe $600 to $900 billion in what they call physical infrastructure, which is, you know, money for airports and highways and tunnels and bridges, what in the old days we used to call transportation bills. In the old days, everyone in Congress loved a good transportation bill. And so these kinds of construction projects, I put broadband in there as well, expanding broadband. Republicans seem to have that notion of infrastructure, and the Biden administration has introduced this concept of human or social, or what they call CARES, after the CARES Act, infrastructure, which are things like elder care, child care, support for education, all the kinds of things that they believe go hand in hand with improving physical infrastructure. So that's the debate. There is some talk about the possibility that Biden could, in theory, agree to start with a maybe roughly $1 trillion, maybe $900 billion physical package, infrastructure package, and then they'll turn their attention to this human infrastructure. They haven't decided to do that yet, but my sense is that a number of Republicans and even some of the more moderate Democrats, like Joe Manchin, are pushing for that. So we will see if that happens. You know, Karen mentioned the markets doing well, and you know, Republicans, I saw them this weekend arguing that, you know, if you raise the capital gains tax up to 39%, then you raise the corporate tax up to 28%, that's going to tank the market. That's the argument they're making, you know, fair or not. And so the market is always has always some sort of collateral role in these kinds of discussions.
Well, Karen, I'm glad you raised that, because it allowed you, Dean, to sort of explain this debate about what is infrastructure. Is it a bridge? Is it a childcare worker, and so forth? So thanks for calling in, Karen. You know, and Dean, as you mentioned, the cost of these packages, New Hampshire is a fiscally conservative state. So what has been the response here to these trillion-dollar plans, Dean?
Well, I think predictably it splits along party lines. It is true, though, that as a rule, states are happy to take federal dollars, because the programs are being subsidized by federal income tax and other types of federal taxes, so the burden is spread more broadly. And if you get a big chunk of federal dollars, as New Hampshire did with the original pandemic relief bill, you know, that allows you not to have to raise property taxes or other kinds of fees and income tax to fund state-centered programs. The concern among conservatives always is that if we saw this all the way, I remember with Barack Obama's Recovery Act in 2009, the idea of unfunded mandates, that, yeah, the federal government will give you some seed money for new programs, but then 2-3 years down the road, you're going to be on your own to fund them. So that's always a concern. But, you know, I think on the one hand, it's predictably divisive. But on the other hand, states certainly are always happy to take federal dollars.
Well, thank you for calling, Karen. And again, our number is 800-892-6477. Tell us your thoughts on the first 100 days of the Biden administration. What have you noticed? What has jumped out for you? What have you liked? What have you not liked? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. And our number is 800-892-6477. So, Dean, here's an email from Rick who says, I think the president is doing a great job. I am frustrated by Republicans who complain about him not working to unite the country as they seem set on obstructing any of what he is trying to do to rebuild our country. Rick says, I really think President Biden is thinking big and trying to make our country better. I'd like to ask you a little bit more about Republicans, Dean. The president has stressed many, many times bipartisanship. Republicans have said he's talking it, but not walking it. So what have you seen?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, President Biden did talk a lot about bipartisanship and played up his ability to navigate the challenges of legislating in Congress. You know, obviously he's got many decades of experience and in particular in understanding the ways of the Senate. You know, my expectation going into his administration was that it would, as has been true for virtually every other modern president, those kind of hopes tend to fall apart rather quickly when you encounter the reality of electoral politics. And there, you know, there's a very powerful group within the Republican Party that is primarily focused on, you know, kind of base mobilization politics and responding to a set of incentives that do not really line up with the idea of bipartisanship. You know, this is not something new. For many years now, bipartisanship has been viewed in contrast to, you know, the 60s and 70s and even a little bit in the 80s. Bipartisanship is now viewed as kind of a weakness. It's viewed as political weakness. I think social media has really kind of augmented this problem. So the Biden administration, in predictably hitting that wall, did two things. They went to the budget reconciliation process almost immediately, which allowed them to avoid a filibuster in the Senate. You know, they believe that Barack Obama waited too long and negotiated away too much in the 2009 recovery package. So they weren't going to waste time doing that. And the second thing they did was they came up with a, I think, reasonably smart idea of saying that look at public opinion in the nation. A lot of these proposals are very popular with independents and Republicans more broadly in the country. So bipartisanship was very quickly redefined as not necessarily cutting deals in Congress, but building a bipartisan coalition of public support in the country for these programs. I mean, this is an old strategy. There's a famous book that was written in the 1980s by a political scientist called Going Public. It's the idea that you go public to put pressure on Congress. So, you know, the thinking is that if you can get a majority of Republicans and independents in the country to support these proposals, then that may in some way leverage Congress.
Yeah, that's what Ayesha Rascoe talked about. It's a gamble.
It's a gamble. I don't know that it's going to happen, but that's what they're trying.
Well, here's an email from Michael who says, Biden has called the filibuster racist, is entertaining packing the courts, has accused or called Republican state leaders of engaging in Neanderthal thinking or Jim Crow legislation, and has proposed trillions of dollars of spending. Thank you, Michael, for writing. And Dean, what about some of that language from the president?
Yeah, you know, much of politicking is rhetoric. We all, political scientists often talk about the rhetorical presidency, which is the power of the bully pulpit, and increasingly in this modern age of social media, when people are plugged into words and video and audio all the time, what you say can have a real impact. So, you know, some of the things that were mentioned in the email, the court packing, I don't sense that Biden ever took that seriously. I think that was a nod to some in the Democratic Party who feel like the Republicans have now taken not one but two Supreme Court picks, Gorsuch and Amy Coney Barrett, the two picks that should have gone to Democratic presidents. So there was that kind of payback issue. I don't expect anything to happen with that. You know, on the Neanderthal comment, you know, he's trying to walk a fine line. He obviously wants to kind of pursue or at least explore bipartisanship and kind of, you know, generally he's perceived as being kind of a nice guy. But on the other hand, there is a lot of restlessness and anger within the Democratic Party about the social environment and the polarized nature of our politics. And so, you know, he wants to show that he's kind of, you know, he understands their concerns as well. But yeah, you know, presidents inevitably say things that can come back to bite them sometimes.
Yeah, well, and all the talk that we heard from the president about let's dial down the temperature, comments like that don't seem to help dial it down.
That's right.
A couple more questions for you, and this is a more specific policy question, Dean. Both Presidents Obama and Trump often said that they thought the U.S. should not stay in Afghanistan much longer. But Joe Biden, in his first 100 days, says, you know, we're out of there. I mean, how struck were you by that?
That's a great question. There's been speaking of social media, there's just been a fascinating discussion about the decision to pull out of Afghanistan. You know, you always hear opponents say that presidents should never telegraph what they're going to do. You know, you should never announce troop withdrawals or troop movements in advance. But the big debate now is whether or not, you know, some folks object to the phrase of a forever war. They don't see Afghanistan as a war now. They see it largely as kind of us just policing internal politics in the country. You know, it's been a great, you know, human and financial cost to us of 20 years now. There are risks that when we pull out, you know, they're going to be Al-Qaeda and the Taliban are going to kind of be re-energized. My sense is that they'll probably stay in the area in some capacity to keep an eye on things. But I was not surprised to see him make, I think we were at a point where the next president was going to do that.
No matter who it was. That's interesting.
Yeah,
I did get a couple of emails, Dean, from people who were not happy with President Biden's foreign policy so far. Diane says, while President Biden will be commended for accomplishing much on his bucket list, there are promises made while campaigning that don't even appear to be on his radar. The promise to restore relations with Cuba to what was in place during Obama and wiped out through executive order through Trump could easily be reversed through executive order. Diane says, unfortunately, his few responses to questions about U.S.-Cuba relations sounded much more like Trump and much less like Obama. So there's Diane not happy with that aspect of our foreign policy. And then also on policy, we got an email from Grace who says, our nation sees itself as a championship of human rights, yet we have acted and continue to act shamefully in dealing with the migrant crisis. Grace says she was hopeful that President Biden would have a definite plan to help relieve the suffering, reunite families, and legislate a fair and equitable policy right off the bat. So there's an email from Grace. And Ayesha Roscoe told us earlier that Vice President Kamala Harris has been sort of charged with dealing with migrant issues at the border. Thanks both to those folks for writing. You know, it's interesting, Dean, to hear from them, because so much of what we talked about this hour has focused on domestic policy. What's your take on sort of the foreign policy ethos of this new administration, Dean?
Yeah, this is a great issue, and it particularly because historically Joe Biden has kind of been viewed as sort of a foreign policy guy. This is something that he really reveled in terms of policy making and diplomacy, et cetera. And so you would expect him to really be engaged in this. I think kind of the immediate economic and pandemic circumstances have turned his attention to these domestic policies, and a lot of this has been very important to core Democratic constituencies. I think the biggest takeaway right now for the Biden foreign policy is a kind of fundamental conceptual shift away from Donald Trump's, America First, America Goes Alone. You know, Trump viewed a lot of our alliances as drags on our finances and not particularly helpful. He did not like what he perceived as free riding by other allies. Biden, I think, is fundamentally re-engaging our core set of allies and treaty obligations in a way that is very different from Trump. But I think it's going to take them some time to see any potential benefits pay off from that. But it is a very clear shift in my view from this sort of America alone, America first, to kind of multilateral alliances as the primary means by which the U.S. re-engages the world.
So real quickly, Dean, just in the minute or so we have left, how much are President Biden's actions right now already being done with an eye towards the 2022 midterms?
Oh, I think absolutely. They know they're on a very short clock. They know there's a likelihood of better than 50% chance they'll lose one or both chambers of Congress. That's just kind of the reality of midterms. And so we may see them go back to the budget reconciliation well one or two more times if they can, just to get as much done as they can before 2022. They're well aware of the political constraints that they face.
Well, and I don't like to talk about the midterms because I feel like I'm still getting over last year's elections, but I did have to ask that, Dean. Thank you very much for being with us. It's been nice to talk to you again.
Sure. My pleasure, Laura. Happy to do it.
That's Dean Spiliotis. He's civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University. Today's show was produced by Exchange producer Jane Vaughn. And Exchange listeners, we always like to hear from you, and we have an opportunity for you to give us some feedback. Tell us what you think about the program. Submit ideas for future shows. You can find it all at our survey. It's nhpr.org/surveys. Tell us what you think about the show. nhpr.org/surveys. Thanks, everybody, for being with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.